O Lord, let my spirit glow so brightly that darkness will disappear. Amen. That prayer, O Lord, let my spirit glow so brightly that darkness will despair, is an Islamic children's prayer. It comes from Pakistan. In fact, praying for anything to overcome darkness seems to be a regular prayer that we offer these days, for there is much in the world that feels dark and foreboding. Received a text from someone yesterday just commenting on the fact that this is the, I don't know how many weeks in a row, that there's been some significant event of violence in our world that presses upon us as we gather in worship. A few weeks ago, I had come across a blessing that was written by a woman by the name of Jan Richardson. She's a United Methodist minister, an artist, an author, and has several places on the internet where you can find her. My favorite is a blog that is called The Painted Prayer Book. When she had heard of the tragic shooting in Orlando, she posted the following prayer. I almost read it a few weeks ago and then was distracted and read something else. I was reminded of it this week because Deb Faust had posted it on her Facebook page following the death of her mother. And it touched me, and I want to share that, for it speaks of endings, be they violent endings or just the endings that we face in our lives. Blessing when the world is ending. Look, the world is always ending somewhere. Somewhere the sun has come crashing down. Somewhere it has gone completely dark. Somewhere it has ended with the gun, the knife, the fist. Somewhere it has ended with the slammed door and the shattered hope. Somewhere it has ended with the utter quiet that follows the news from the phone, the television, the hospital room. Somewhere it has ended with a tenderness that will break your heart. But listen, this blessing means to be anything but morose. It has not come to cause despair. It is simply there because there is nothing a blessing is better suited for than an ending. Nothing that cries out more for a blessing than when a world is falling apart. This blessing will not fix you, will not mend you, will not give you false comfort. It will not talk to you about one door opening when another one closes. It will simply sit itself beside you among the shards and gently turn your face toward the direction from which the light will come, gathering itself about you as the world begins again. It reminded me of a hymn that I learned several years ago. It's from the alternate hymnal of the Episcopal Church, Wonder, Love, and Praise, one of our alternate hymnals. It's written, the text, by Dean Nelson. It's an Advent hymn. Signs of ending all around us, dark and death and winter days, shroud our lives with fear and sadness, numbing mouths that long to praise. Come, O Christ, and dwell among us. Hear our cries. Come, set us free. Give us hope and faith and gladness. Show us what there yet can be. We've all been reminded of the dangers of being human. We are frail and failed creatures, and bad things happen to us. But good things happen to us as well. And both the hymn and the blessing, which I just read, remind us that the world is not coming to an end. There have been bad days, but there have been worse days in the past, and there will likely be worse days in the future, and there'll be better days as well. I'll never forget in the days following the attack on 9/11. We were in Hawaii at the time, a place that knew something about attacks. And a friend of mine who served a predominantly Japanese congregation was fretting what he was going to say on that first Sunday. And a little lady about yay tall came up to him, a Japanese woman who had lived her entire life in Hawaii and witnessed the attack on Pearl Harbor. And she tugged on his vestments and said, "Father Rob, it's okay. We know how to do this. It's okay. We know how to do this." Despite what we hear in the news from politicians and those who claim to know everything, there may be dark days that we face, but the world, our nation, life is not coming to an end. Certainly we experience those deaths in our own lives and those tragedies. Today I'm mindful, I mentioned that Deborah Faust's mother died last week. Emil Gombosi's mother died this past week as well, and yesterday John Hayward's mother died. So there is death all around us. And yet we gather ourselves as God gathers us, and we begin the world again. In our readings today, we hear a number of things. We hear about and we witness prayer. Jesus tells us how to pray, and he gives us essentially an outline of what has come to be known as the Lord's Prayer. I think Jesus would be befuddled at the fact that we stand up and say that, and every time we gather for worship or for many other occasions. It was not designed to be something that we recite word for word. It has become so much a part of Christian worship that we don't even need to look at it to say it. And God help us if someone dares change the words. I'm tempted sometime, not today, but just I warn you. I want us to open up sometimes where we actually have the Lord's Prayer printed. There's two versions of it. Have you noticed that? Side by side. We always gravitate over to the one that's the more traditional one that has trespasses instead of sins. And unless we come from the Presbyterian tradition, in which case we're more fond of debts. There's a sermon in that, I think. Where's Rick Lancel when I need him? In the passage from Genesis, we have another type of prayer, also known as bargaining. Careful when a warden comes up to you before worship and says, I want you to do something. I want you to play God. If I could only play God when it really counted. But here we have a type of prayer, an intercession on behalf of others, where Abraham is doing his best to save the God-forsaken cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And begs God that would God not just save those places if there were but a few righteous people, and whittles it down from 50 to 45 to 30 to 20. It's like an auction in reverse. You know, can I have 20, 15, 10? And it stops there. We don't know why. My guess is God left the room. But most of us would probably try to get it down even further. Because there's something that's just human nature that we want to know what the minimum requirement is. You know, what do I have to do to get by? You know, how many papers do I have to write? How many classes do I need to attend? How many days do I need to show up for work? How many 6 days do I have? Vacation? What's the least that we can do to get the job done? And sometimes that's even, what do I need to do to make sure that I'm going to get my reward and at the pearly gates? Episcopalians don't worry too much about that. We're assured that we're all going to be there anyway. Other denominations are not so sure of us. We wonder about what is the minimum requirement for being a member of the church. We've been doing a lot of talking about membership rate lately, and it's sort of a ridiculous term anyway. I mean, the whole notion of being a member of the church, as if we are members, we're one up on those that aren't. It's playing this same game of what's required of us. You know what the requirement for membership is in the Episcopal Church? We use language that sounds really fancy. We say to be a communicant in good standing. A communicant in good standing. That means you have to make your communion. You have to come, show up, or be taken communion. You don't even have to show up. Hopefully it's for good reason that you're not showing up. But you need to make your communion 3 times in one calendar. 3 times! Somebody said, why 3? Well, that means you have to show up on some day other than Christmas and Easter, because they don't count. So if you make it one other time, and this is the good one, and if you're known to the treasurer. Known to the treasurer. That doesn't mean you walk up to Gary and say, hi, my name is. I think we all know how we get to be known by the treasurer. But 3 times a year? I mean, could we get the bar any lower? Some try. And we bargain. But what if? What if? If only for 10 righteous will you save the city. Now there's a positive aspect of this whole thing that Abraham picks up on. Notice that Abraham doesn't say, will you just save the 50 righteous? And, you know, let the rest of them go on. No, he says, will you save the whole city for the sake of the 50 righteous? So there's something about a righteous person that has some qualities of salvation for those that are just around him or her. That's a good message. It says that for those that are right with the Lord, there's hope for the rest of us simply because they're practicing a behavior, living according to an attitude that God finds to be worthy. Well, what is righteousness anyway? Unfortunately, our best understanding of righteousness is when we refer to self-righteousness. We know what that is. That's what other people act like. It's when they're seeming to be better than us. But righteousness is not puffing oneself up. It's not making oneself to be better than the other. Righteousness has to do with living a life that is filled with justice and with kindness and with mercy. It's not just about looking good or even being good by some arbitrary standard. It's about fulfilling God's will in the lives of people, and that is to do justice and to love kindness and to humbly walk with God. What strikes me in this story of petitioning for the saving of these places, Sodom and Gomorrah, and how we often pray that God would spare us for any reason whatsoever, is what is not being asked is the very thing that is our primary purpose as the church. And that is not to try to talk God into preserving us because of the few righteous folk that we have among us, but rather that God would strengthen us and we would be willing to go out and make more righteous. Rather than starting with 50 and dwindling it down to 10, why don't we start at 50 and work our way up to 75 or to 100 or to countless numbers of people who would strive for justice and peace and harmony? I know that we've all been struck by the senseless acts of violence that we witness practically every day. Do you know what I think is even worse than what we've seen in the killing of other people? Fear is understandable, but increasingly I witness the horrible way other human beings are treating one another because of that fear. Go on to any blog, go on to anything on the internet where people can respond to a news item. And just listen or read the way people are talking about one another. I don't care what your political leanings are or who you plan to vote for in November. But I think how many people are failing miserably in the attempt to do justice, to respect the dignity of every human being. Every human being. And that includes Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I don't care if you don't like them. God does not ask us who we like, but we're called to respect one another. Even those idiots that write things online before they even think, who call one another human garbage And that's about the nicest thing I can quote from some of the things that I've read. That is not being righteous. It's not even being nice. Let us not argue and whittle God down to our level, where 3 times a year, way down there, that low bar is all we need to do to be communicants in good standing. It's not even enough if we just keep our mouths shut. But that when we see acts of unkindness, that we respond with acts of mercy. I started today with that Islamic child's prayer and with the blessing that was written by Jan Richardson. Jan has also written about a year ago, and she pulled it out and posted it again, a blessing in a time of violence, which spoke to me. A blessing in a time of violence, which is to say, this blessing is always, because there's always violence. Which is to say, there is no place this blessing does not long to cry out in lament, to weep its words in sorrow, to scream its lines in sacred rage. Which is to say, there is no day this blessing ceases to whisper into the ear of the dying, the despairing, the terrified. Which is to say, there is no moment this blessing refuses to sing itself into the heart of the hated and the hateful, the victim and the victimizer, with every last ounce of hope it has. Which is to say, there is none that can stop it, none that can halt its course, none that will still its cadence, none that will delay its rising, none that can keep it from springing forth. From the mouths of us who hope, from the hands of us who act, from the hearts of us who love, from the feet of us who will not cease our stubborn, aching, marching, until this blessing has spoken its final word, until this blessing has breathed its benediction in every place, in every tongue. Peace, peace, peace.